So most people don't really like dirt. I mean, most people are taught to clean the dirt off of themselves, taught that dirt has to do with disease or with neglect of your, you know, personal grooming habits or housekeeping. But I gather, David Montgomery, you don't feel quite the same way. What does that description of dirt leave out?
Well, it leaves out sort of how fundamentally important it is to our lives and to how the world is run. You know, dirt is kind of a derogatory word for soil. And this is the only planet we know of that has soil, a mix of biology and geology that quite literally spins the wheel of life, recycling the dead products of biology into the new materials for putting new life together. So, you know, dirt, if you think of it expansively, is one of the most important things that we actually have on this planet. And it's kind of gotten a bad name, in part, well, because of what we've chosen to call it.
So is there one thing that you wish people knew about dirt, or one little point of view on dirt that you think people ought to entertain in order to broaden their minds on the subject?
Boy, well, you know, the thing as a geologist that I think about when I first go to it and I've written a lot about is just how slow it forms, how fragile it is, how delicate it is, and yet how essential it is to life. So we take it for granted, literally, the ground beneath our feet that we walk around on, kick around. We don't respect it in our modern agriculture. Yet it is so fundamentally important to life above ground that we just kind of see right through it. So just even being aware of it and how important it is probably would be revolutionary.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and Dr. David Montgomery of the Earth and Space Sciences Department at the University of Washington is going to be back a little bit later in the hour to talk a little more about his lifelong love affair with dirt, as well as plenty of other tales from around the region of dirt and the dirt on dirt. So we're going to get to all that in just a few moments. But first, as always, we are going to break down the week's news with our panel of experts. So stick around for that. We're gathered once again to chew over the week's top story and maybe restore some balance to the universe by talking about some of our underreported stories. And here to help us do that is Ansel Hirst, reporter at The Stranger. Joanne Lisowski is a professor of communication at Pacific Lutheran University. And Erica C. Barnett just took a new job in communications with NARAL, the reproductive rights organization. And she also blogs covering politics and wonkery at thecsforcrank.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome
Hi,
to Sound
hello.
Effect.
Hey.
Good to have you all back. So for our top story this week, it's, of course, the arrival of the big Arctic drilling rig at the port of Seattle that was towed into Elliott Bay through a gauntlet of floating protesters. So first off, you know, the city and the port had quickly yanked away the welcome mat in the last few days. Seattle said that Foss Maritime's permit's not valid. They need to apply for a new one. The port asked Shell to hold off, and yet there it is, anchored off of Terminal 5. So how did that happen? And what does it say about who's in charge of what here? Maybe we could start with you, Erica.
Well, it happened because the port said it was okay to happen. And frankly, the mayor of the city, Ed Murray, could not really do much about it at that point. He's asking the port to go back and ask Foss Maritime to apply for a new permit. That will only delay Shell. It will not stop it.
Well, it actually didn't delay them even, right?
Right, they're here.
They're here. It proceeds apace. Ansel, I know you had a lot to say about it when Mayor Murray made that announcement. Now it looks like it didn't have a practical effect. What do you think of it?
Well, actually, Mike McGinn pointed something out really interesting on our Stranger podcast. That is that Ed Murray has said that he knew that the port was interested in bringing Shell to Seattle back in November. And at that time, he didn't say anything about it. And really the key issue here has been that the port did so much of this decision-making on bringing Shell here in the dark and didn't inform people. And only at the very last second, when there were public meetings right before they made the final decision, were people given the chance to show up, pack the room, protest. But by then, it seemed like the decision had already been made at the Port of Seattle. Ed Murray knew about that back in the fall. He didn't apply sunshine. He didn't raise a heck about it. And so the movement is kind of just now catching up and getting organized. And it's been amazing to see so many people getting kayaks and get out on the water. Well, and just so everybody understands, the goal, as I understand it, of the kayaktivists, the folks in kayaks, is to actually let the oil rig come into the port of Seattle and then to block it from leaving. And so, you know, we'll see what happens. The Coast Guard has said that there needs to be a safety buffer zone of, I think, 500 feet.
500 when it's moving.
Right.
You know, Murray's action was obviously symbolic, as are the protesters. I don't think that bringing it up in November would have stopped it. I do think that, you know, if that is true, you know, he did deal with this a month ago. So arguably, you know, it would have been great if he had said something and allowed the protest to start earlier. However, on Thursday night at a forum for city council candidates, Bill Bradbird, one of the candidates for position 8, said something interesting. He said, you know, what would really be effective is if all of the ports up and down the West Coast, I'm sure he's not the only one who's pointed this out, if they had all agreed in advance and if cities, you know, had sort of coordinated, these protests could have been more than symbolic.
I think that this is a perfect example of social movement theory. And social movement theory suggests that you don't need to be effective in order to change public opinion. And the fact that the media is playing into this and following this story so significantly, it's what we're talking about here. Shellzilla, right? The monster that ate Seattle, right? And it's across every, it's the first story on every newscast. So people are paying attention. People are getting more involved. I mean, the unfortunate thing is we've also, I'm sorry to give my politics out here, but the unfortunate thing is that the president was even quoted as saying, this is going to happen, folks. No matter what you do, this is happening.
I would add, Danny Westneat in the Seattle Times had a column recently that I thought was, I'll just say this, a little disingenuous, sort of slagging on protesters and the city in general.
Well, he was really going after the politicians, I have to say.
Politicians in the city. That's okay, fair enough. But saying that, you know, flailing their arms is not going to be effective. So they need to, you know, go to the state and get changes and go to the federal government and get changes. But the fact is, city politicians really can't do a whole lot. What they can do is lend their name and their mm-hmm. voice to issues like Arctic drilling and to issues like the Polar Pioneer docking here.
And just, I think people should keep in mind that the Port of Seattle commissioners are elected. And I think for a long time, nobody's really paid attention. Who the heck are we electing? Who are these people? Doesn't really matter. Clearly, it matters. And so next time, I think all of those commissioners, there's going to be much more of a focus on what is their record.
And the Northwest Port Authority, that whole idea of working with Tacoma. Tacoma is now sort of backing up from working with the
from
Seattle
From the cooperation.
Port. Yes.
Interesting. Over this kind of a lightning rod.
Yeah, they're just like, whoa, do we want to really be associated with those people that let this big behemoth move in and not say anything about it?
Well, that behemoth is going to be anchored off the terminal for a little while to come. So we're very likely
to
be.
I think it is.
Well. Indeed. Well, I'm sure be revisiting this story regardless. So let's move now into our underreported stories of the week. And Erica Barnett, what's your underreported story?
My underreported story is the release of the Seattle 2035 plan, which is basically the guiding planning document for the entire region. Basically, the 2035 plan, for which the EIS, the Environmental Impact Statement, was released this week, it lays out four different ways that we could plan to grow in the future. One of them is essentially, let's keep doing everything the same. And then it's an increasing series of density around transit. So one is do everything the same. Four is let's build density around transit so that people can get to work, can have a life without a car or without driving a car everywhere. And it has been really controversial at the city level, probably unbeknownst to most people, because some, like Nick Licata on the city council, are saying that really we need a fifth plan that minimizes displacement of people who are already living by transit. Now, that in theory is a good idea. However, the whole point of building what's called transit-oriented development, TOD, is to make it so that people can live close to how they get to work. And if we just limit transit, you know, if we don't build transit in areas where poor people are, then those are always going to be, you know, people who are disadvantaged by not being able to get around.
Social engineering is messy.
Yeah, and we have to do social engineering. I mean, people believe that, you know, social engineering is a bad thing, but every decision made by the city and the state and, you know, so on is social engineering. So that's what planning is, and we're doing that for the next 20 years in this document. So everybody should go and read all 800 or however many pages there are of it right now.
I will
give up your Saturday.
I will happily take you up on that. All right, thanks for that, Erica. How about you, Ansel? What's your underreported story?
My underreported story is another report from another city agency. In this case, it's the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs. And they issued a report right before May Day, which as far as I can tell, nobody has covered. It was about impediments to voting for immigrants in Seattle. The report found that in 2013, only 33% of eligible immigrant voters in Seattle, in fact, voted. That's compared to 58% for the overall population. These are members of our community who should have a say in what's going on locally. May Day, theoretically, or at least since 2006, was supposed to be about immigrant rights. We saw some huge demonstrations over the years trying to push for immigration reform. Part of the reason immigration reform, I think, hasn't happened, and then even here in the state of Washington, you know, things like the Voting Rights Act have not been passed, is because these populations of immigrants have not been voting. They do not turn out. And there are things that the city can do to make that process easier. They can cut down on how much it costs for immigrants to register. They can make ballot boxes more accessible in certain areas. So this report just laid out a series of common sense steps for the city to take, and it got no coverage. And so in that sense, it's totally underreported.
It's non-reported.
Yeah.
Non-reported story of the week. Well, thanks for bringing it to our attention. And Joanne, how about you? What is your underreported story?
Well, I'm surprised I haven't heard more about this, but I realize that it was in negotiation for a while. But the beloved Facebook has now launched into the instant news business, and it happened on Wednesday. And they've partnered with NBC, The Atlantic, BuzzFeed, National Geographic, and The New York Times. And that's a little disturbing to me. Apparently, they're trying to get closer to young consumers. Pew Center, another report for people in the press, has suggested that 47% of people who are on the internet get their news from Facebook, which is also frightening. However, I have sort of a contradiction to that, too. I noticed last Sunday in the Tacoma News Tribune, Karen Peterson was talking about a study that they did with the American Press Institute, where they are finding that people are appreciating longer stories, stories over 1,000 words, that they are more engaged, 20% more engaged in those kinds of stories. So it seems maybe is the New York Times like hooking their wagon to Facebook at the wrong time? Maybe Facebook should be doing longer stories instead of shorter stories. I don't know what it means.
All right. Well, thanks for that. I really appreciate all of you guys making your return appearance on Sound Effect. Thank you so much to Erica C. Barnett, who blogs about Seattle politics and news and gossip at thecsforcrank.com. Ansel Hurst is a reporter for The Stranger, and Joanne Lisowski is a professor of communications at PLU and also an inductee into the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Silver Circle. Don't tell me to stop talking. I'm going to tell them all. Thank you guys for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
This is Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We're talking about dirt today. The dirt we live on, the dirt we turn into once we're gone, the dirt we dish on other people. But for this first story, we sent KPLU's Matthew Strybe to the prison in Monroe. And he wanted to go there to learn more about a program they have where inmates and worms go into business together. And their work is turning human refuse into fertile soil.
That disgusting noise is the sound of one big happy family. It's about 500,000 slimy red worms wriggling in a giant laundry bin. They are just part of over 6.5 million worms cared for by inmates at the Monroe Correctional Complex in Snohomish County. The program is part of the Sustainability in Prisons Project, a partnership between the Evergreen State College and the Washington Department of Corrections. Program manager Kelly Bush says the project saves the state money, limits carbon emissions, and provides offenders job skills for after their release.
The general public really underestimates the intelligence of the incarcerated population. This is a group of people that are really eager to assist and who are, you know, very smart and very innovative. And I think that, you know, our belief is that we should be working with them more as partners to address science and sustainability issues.
There are now about 3,000 inmates across the state involved in sustainability programs. But in the worm program at Monroe, there's only 4. Nick Hackney is the inmate who runs it. He's a former Bainbridge Island pastor who's serving time for strangling his wife with a plastic bag and setting their home on fire. You wouldn't know it by meeting him, though. He's jovial and talkative and extremely knowledgeable about worms and ecology.
We're losing our topsoil in the world anywhere from 10 to 40 times our ability to replenish it. So the worms here are a worm called the Cyna fetida. If you had a horse farm or
worms,
a goat farm or something, they're breaking down this material in a mesophilic or low heat process, which doesn't...
Hackney wasn't always a science nut, but he's halfway through serving a 26-year sentence, which he said can be very boring. To occupy his mind, Hackney has taken years of correspondence courses and written researchers around the country to keep up with the latest science. So when Edmonds Community College donated 200 worms to the prison in 2010, he jumped at the chance to breed them into the more than 6 million there are today. He works at the worm program the majority of the week, earning 42 cents an hour to keep the worms alive. He says he likes the routine because it's like a real job.
It's felt very normal, like a normal life, as opposed to, a term that you hear a lot in prison, which is warehousing. And that's kind of the other end of prison experiences, where you're just sitting in your cell, for long days, walking the yard, maybe, going in the day room playing some pinochle.
The worm program fills a vital need at the Monroe Correctional Complex. The worms eat up to 15,000 pounds of food waste every month. That saves the prison thousands of dollars in disposal costs. But it also cuts down on emissions created by dump trucks and methane gas from decomposing food. But in the warehouse-like project facility, you wouldn't know that you're surrounded by mounds of discarded food. That's because the worms eat the food before it rots, and the air smells earthy and healthy, almost like the deep forest. And when the worms poop, they create a nutrient-rich fertilizer to which the inmates then add sugar and water and aerate to make worm tea. The manure and the tea then fertilize the prison's immaculate rows of vegetable and flower gardens. Eventually, they hope to produce enough manure to fertilize the public green space throughout the city of Monroe. Hackney says programs like this that have positive effects on the outside world provide inmates with a sense of self-worth.
Prisons are dark places with barbed wire and walls, and every once in a while you find a crack in the wall. And this program has really been my crack in the wall. It's been a place that I could really thrive and do something that matters and grow. We're people just like everybody else. We care about the world our kids are growing up in and our grandkids are going to grow up in and whatnot, I've talked to guys from all over the state that have participated in the Sustainability in Prisons projects. And that's something that everybody has said is, man, prior to getting involved in this program, I didn't really care much one day to another what my days were made up. And now I've got something that I really genuinely care about.
The worm program at Monroe has been such a success that it's been copied at the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla, the Stafford Creek Correction Center, and prisons nationwide. Michelle Wood is the associate superintendent at the Monroe Correctional Complex. She says the skills offenders learn in the worm program give them hope for a better life after release that other prison jobs just can't offer.
They can see how maybe when they get out of here that is something they could do that might actually help them make a good living, whereas working in the kitchen's kind of just it's kind of a dead-end job. I mean, you can go out and be a dishwasher for any restaurant, and really, where's that leading to you for you as a career? Where some of these guys are, when they get out of here, they plan on making a career in worm farming.
Nick Hackney still has about a decade left to serve in prison. But even after that, he sees worms in his future.
There is kind of a vermiculture world out there. I'm part of that world. I mean, there's people out there that know about the Monroe worm farm in all over the United States and that write to me. And there is kind of a fraternity of worm farmers out there. When I get out, I mean, I think that, worms are going to be part of my life forever now. It's far too valuable of a environmental lesson. But I'd love to be a person that is out there setting up worm bins, maybe for other facilities.
Typically, an inmate is only allowed to work a job for 2 years before he is required to be reassigned. But because of Hackney's dedication to the worms, his assignment has been repeatedly extended. He says it's hard not to grow fond of the invertebrates.
I guess it sounds kind of sappy to get personally attached to some worms, but I think for the most part we are. I mean, there's not one of us that hasn't stopped to pick up a worm off the floor that fell out of a bin and stick him back in there. And it's, you know, I've even seen a few of these guys talk to the worms at times. So I never do that, but these guys do.
That story from KPLU's Matthew Stribe. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm standing here with Katrina Spade. We're at 15th and Gaylor in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood. And Katrina, maybe you can explain the panorama before us here. What is around us?
Sure. To our right, we've got Lakeview Cemetery spread out down the hill. We've got a bunch of 6 and 7-year-olds playing on the playground here in front of us. And then over to the left is Volunteer Park, my favorite park in the city.
So the show today is about dirt or soil or dust, and of course from dust we come and to dust we shall return, and that is what we're here to talk about. Can you tell us the name of your organization?
Sure, the Urban Death Project.
So this cemetery that's off to our right is where people have been ending up for quite a long time, but the park off to our left is what you have in mind for where we might end up in the future.
Sort of. It's part of what I have in mind. I've envisioned and designed a system that'll compost our deceased, quite simply, and then a new type of architecture for our cities where we can have a ceremony to say goodbye and come back to and remember and memorialize our dead. So it has to do with the park in part because it's about nourishing new life, but it's also about a new type of architecture and a new space in our cities to not only appreciate the people we've lost, but also contemplate our place in the natural world.
Tell me more, paint me a picture of what this facility that you have in mind is.
It's a 3-story core in which carbon materials like wood chips and sawdust and bodies are placed, and over time they decompose quite naturally and turn into soil. Of course, it's a little bit more involved than that because we're mechanically aerating and hydrating and testing the material that we're creating. But it's really at its essence quite a simple process.
So after the bodies go into the core and they're stirred up, you have to stir them up, right?
We don't have to stir them up. This is the beautiful thing and to me really important in the process. Bodies will be laid in by friends and family into the wood chips and then still for the next 2 to 3 weeks as they do the first stage of decomposition. And I think that's really important to be able to imagine your loved one, if you want to, decomposing slowly, completely naturally, and with only gravity and, you know, the natural forces at work. Then we have a second stage in the system after the body has transformed from human to a coarse compost material. Then we will do a sorting and screening for things like titanium hips and golden teeth, and also a finishing stage of the compost.
So what you wind up with is a soil-like compost. And since we're standing here in a grove of trees here in Volunteer Park, talk about where that soil might go.
I have 3 ways I envision the soil being used. The first is that friends and family, of course, would be encouraged and welcome to come and take some of the compost, grow a tree or memorial garden, or nourish their rose gardens in the backyard.
Though they'd be mixed with some other sources, right?
You mean other people?
Yes.
Yes, indeed. You're right. The second way is for every one of these facilities to have gardens on site. They should look very different depending on the neighborhood and the designers, but I think it would be beautiful to have the compost nourishing those gardens. Then you can come back to that place and really feel like it becomes a place of memorial for your family member, your friend. And the third thing I would love to do is create partnerships with city parks. So you're standing here in Volunteer Park, and imagine if you knew that your grandmother's compost had been used to nourish this park. I think that would be really special, a special way to remember her. And also it's a way to sort of fold our dead back into the cities. And that's part of the idea of this project, not having to leave the city after we've died.
What started you thinking about this? How did this idea sort of take shape in your head?
I was in graduate school at the University of Massachusetts Amherst in architecture, and I had 2 small children, and they were at that moment where in their lives where they grow up in front of your very eyes. They're growing that fast. And I remember looking at one of them and saying, oh, they're growing that fast. And just it hit me that I was growing at the same rate. And that, yes, I too was going to die someday. And I began to wonder what my non-religious family, who kind of loved nature, would do. And what I, as an urban dweller, could have as a meaningful way to dispose of my body when I died. And so being in architecture school, I got to spend 2 years really thinking about the issues, studying the existing options we have, and then designing a new option.
What is the problem you're trying to solve exactly? What is wrong with that cemetery over there? I understand you say you don't think it's necessary, but, you know, when we're talking about upending a cultural sort of pillar like this, there must be a good reason, right?
Well, the compelling reason is I don't want my last gesture on this earth to be a toxic one. We walk through the world, taking in nutrients through the air we breathe, through the food we eat, and I think the best thing to do when we die is to give it back in whatever way we can.
How much of this is symbolic, and how much of it is a practical effort at sustainability?
One of the things that drives me is that this project is very pragmatic at its base. At the same time, it feels to me almost spiritual to be turning back to soil after we've died to grow new life. To me, that's about the closest I think I'll get to living again.
So when someone hears what you want to do and says, that is gross, how do you engage with that person, or do you?
The first thing I like to say is, gently, why don't you consider looking into what the embalming process entails? I guarantee you'll come out of there thinking, that is gross, and disrespectful to the body, in fact. But the truth is, I'm not trying to convince everyone that this is the way. I think, if you find cremation meaningful, if you want to be buried in a casket in a concrete grave liner full of embalming fluid, I fully support that. I actually think we just need more options available to us.
May I ask, have you lost anyone lately?
Yeah, actually, I've lost two people I love very dearly in the past year since really launching this project. Both deaths, my grandmother and my brother-in-law, were the way the deaths were treated were beautiful in different ways. And both of them affirmed the work I was doing, or I am doing. So with my grandmother's death, I was there just up until the very end, and she was 95, I think, and she was so ready to go, and it was incredibly beautiful. And it reminded me that death can be beautiful. It isn't always, but it can be. With my brother-in-law, he died very suddenly, and there was nothing beautiful about that at all. But then we had a home funeral for him at his family's home in New Hampshire, and we spent 3 days with his body in the room with us on dry ice, not embalmed, in a coffin, a pine coffin, and we mourned him together in this way that was very special and much more close and involved, I think, than we are usually given the opportunity to do. And so that, again, was really a reminder that it's about providing families and friends with more opportunity to be close to their loved one, to actually take part in the preparing of the body, to actually be part of saying goodbye and not to pass it off to some professionals they've never met before. And there's something to be gained, I think, for the grieving and in the grieving process by being closer to the body of the deceased. It's not easy. There's nothing easy about it. But I think there is something that deepens the grieving process in an important way. We really, truly are going to die someday, each one of us. And if we realize that, the saying goes, and I think it's true, we live better. We're kinder. We're more present. We appreciate things as we go. I think that's true. I think I found it in my work as I continue to think about death each and every day. I think it makes me live better.
Katrina Spade is the founder and executive director of the Urban Death Project. Well, thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we are talking about dirt today, and we've got a, something of a dirt expert here. Dr. David Montgomery is a geomorphologist, and he works in the UW Department of Earth and Space Sciences. He's also the recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship in 2008. This is the one that's often referred to as the Genius Grant. And the MacArthur Foundation attributed to him a scientist's rigor, a historian's curiosity, and an environmentalist's passion. But they left something out. A blues man's growl. When did you start playing music, David?
About when I was 16. I think I bought a bass guitar when I was 16. Although, technically, I started, I think, in fourth grade when I took up the trumpet and was advised to quit because I had no musical talent. But I started playing bass at 16 and been playing in bands most of the time on, sometimes off, like when I was getting tenure, in between.
I was going to say, did you play throughout your dissertation?
Oh, yeah. That's what kept me sane.
Why did you call your band Big Dirt?
It was called Big Dirt for a couple reasons. The one we like to advertise is that Big Dirt is kind of shorthand for planet Earth. And, you know, I'm a geologist. It kind of fits. We're kind of an environmentally themed band at some levels, although we kind of hit on all kinds of subjects. The real story behind it is that the way you name a band usually is when you start a new band, you sort of go around the table, hey, who's got a band idea name? You throw ideas out, and then everybody vetoes everything. There's a couple left. When we did that, Big Dirt was the last one on the table. Nobody vetoed it, and it had been the name of a computer in my lab.
Oh.
Yes. So there's sort of the official story, and then there's the backstory.
All right. Well, behind the music. So when did you know you were a dirt man?
When I was a kid, I just was fascinated by topography. Loved maps, would look at maps of like real places, maps of, you know, fantasy worlds, sort of maps of things, spatial arrangements of the things. Greatly interested me.
What kind of fantasy maps are we talking about?
Oh, you know, like the maps in some editions of Tolkien when I read that when I was a teenager. You know,
I loved
the words, but I also like loved the maps. And I feel very fortunate to have been able to make a career out of studying topography and terrain, and it's beautiful stuff. And when you go out there and you start digging into it, you know, it's covered with dirt. And it turns out that soil, the stuff on top of rocks, unlike what I learned as a geologist as an undergrad, it's that stuff on top that actually helps shape landscapes. It makes a huge difference whether or not there's a covering of dirt on the land. And it makes a huge difference, obviously, for agriculture, what kind of quality it is. And that makes a huge difference what kind of societies develop in different places. And the more you sort of look into and think about how landscapes work and how the ecology folds on top of it and then human societies and civilizations work on top of that, you realize that the soil, the life of the dirt, is really essential to all the kind of things we care about.
So with the point of view that you have on dirt, the complex processes that go into making it what it is, when you're out in the field on a mountaintop or a hillside or slogging through the muck and you're knee deep in the dirt, how does that feel to you?
Well, it's great. I'm not in my office. I'm just amazed that I can make a living where I can go out and go get to some very remote places and get absolutely filthy and look at what's happening below ground, above ground, how they're interconnected. If it's sort of very rich, fertile, earthy soil, I mean, it smells really like life itself, and it's a very invigorating and thrilling kind of perception and emotion. But if you're knee-deep in semi-boiling quicksand, it's a whole different deal. And you know, I've had both experiences, and I prefer one a lot more to the other.
Do you feel like the science and the music exist in completely separate compartments in you, or do they cross over sometimes?
They cross-pollinate in the sense of creativity. I think it's really important in trying to foster creativity to be able to sort of let go and not think in a highly focused manner about things all the time.
A lot of people don't necessarily think of science as a creative endeavor. They think of science as the application of certain rules and being very analytical and structured. How do you think of it as a creative thing?
Oh boy, you know, you could say the same thing about music in a sense, where there's a the structure of scales and knowing the sort of rules behind the creativity, behind the process of generating something either fun, utilitarian, or beautiful, are kind of similar in those two areas, in the sense that you can view sort of statistics and mathematics and models in science kind of the way sort of learning your scales is in music. It's important to essentially the process of sort of getting something that works. But it's not necessarily related to the creative part of it. And in science, it's the questions you ask, the problems you work on.
Can you think of an example of a question that you generated or a relationship that you kind of divined in your scientific work that was a creative act that took a little bit of a leap of creativity to come up with?
Well, you know, the one that comes immediately to mind is there's a project I worked on and looking at landforms on Mars. There's a landform, a feature there that turns out to be a giant landslide, at least that's what we think it is, for which the deepest valley in the solar system, Valles Marineris, that giant trench on Mars that has inspired a lot of thinking about Mars and that there are Martian outburst floods. Well, it turns out this landslide is so big that that's a small tear on the shoulder of it. Thinking of that in a different way, it hadn't been thought of that way when we started looking at it. And we sort of looked at it, stood back, and thought, well, other than the size of this thing, which is outrageously big, what's it look like? How do we think it actually works? And we came to the idea that it was a giant landslide and followed it up. And we're pretty convinced that that is, in effect, what it is. That was an act of creativity in the sense of seeing something in a way that it really hadn't been looked at before or recognized as such. We think it's this. And that's kind of like one of those moments when you're playing music with people, with musicians you've played with before, when you hit it and it's on and you get a run of a few minutes of improvisation where it's just like, that was good. Did we record it?
Please tell me the tape was rolling.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I could sing you songs or I could tell you stories. Could shout all night into the wind. But you and I, we both know it wouldn't change a thing in this world.
Well, David Montgomery is a geomorphologist, a professor at the University of Washington. He's also a MacArthur Fellow and the lead guitarist and songwriter for the band Big Dirt. Thanks so much for being on Sound Effect, David.
Great, thank you.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. Today, we're talking about dirt, and the dirt in the next story is gossip. So for over a decade, Kathleen Wilson wrote gossip in the Northwest, and probably the most notorious of her recurring columns was It's My Party. It ran in The Stranger from the late 90s to 2004. She'd write about records that were coming out and review shows, and she'd report on the often bad behaviors of local musicians.
Biting somebody on the butt or, you know, honking somebody on the boob, doing the double bird back out of a door. That was my favorite one time.
Sound Effect senior producer Arwin Nix spoke with Kathleen Wilson about her long love affair with dishing dirt and how that relationship changed over the years.
Kathleen Wilson grew up in Oregon, and on rainy camping trips with her family, she would sneak away to read her mother's magazines.
There would always be my mom's Rona Barrett gossip, and, you know, I was just fascinated by all the who was dating who and who did this to this person and how much money did this people make.
Her love of gossip continued. As she grew up, it was Teen Beat and then Tiger Beat and the newspaper, anything she could get her hands on, really. She just loved knowing things. And it made sense that when she grew up, she eventually started writing for periodicals. But her pieces on fashion and music, well, they all turned into gossip pieces.
It's like I don't know how else to write unless I'm, like, talking about people. I'll tattle on myself as much as I'll talk about what other people are doing.
Kathleen eventually moved up to Seattle. She started writing for The Stranger and eventually got a job as a staff writer. That's when the column It's My Party began. In It's My Party, Kathleen wrote about everyone. Great musicians, terrible sound people, decent club owners, bartenders, the entire spectrum of musicians and the people they partied with. And she was in the column too. It's My Party was part gossip, part music, and part personal journal. If you read it, you didn't know her, but you sure felt like you did. Then in the summer of 2000, something changed for Kathleen. She got sober. She'd still go to the bar every night and watch people and talk to people and write about people, but it just felt different.
I became much more aware of that I was shining lights on things that maybe made people uncomfortable, because anything that shone on me made me very uncomfortable. I didn't have liquid courage anymore. So.
Did you start to have guilt about what you were writing?
Yeah, really bad guilt. I mean, I remember that there was one weekend I had to leave town because I couldn't, I was just losing it. I over just this guilt of writing about people. Who did I think I was? And, you know, that's not my business. And I came back with this feeling that I have to be more careful. Not necessarily nicer. I don't know if it was because I wanted people to like me, or, you know, or if I just felt I can dish it out and I can't take it and that's not fair.
Was it habit, or was it a role that you were consciously playing to be this version of yourself that wrote these kinds of things about people in this way?
It vacillated between the two, I would say. It was a habit because that's the way I'd always written. Quick and dirty, you know, no time to think about appropriateness. As I got older, I was so did not feel like that person at all, did not want to be that person. Everyone in the office was so much younger. I was, I think, maybe the oldest person working there at the time, and I was not yet 40. And I felt just, I just didn't feel that person. I didn't feel, you know, when I started The Stranger, I had been 10 years younger. And I didn't feel that same voice anymore.
So when did you stop writing gossip?
When I left The Stranger, summer 2004.
Do you ever miss it?
No. No.
Do you ever think about it?
Yes, because I have this thing called, I call it the shutters, you know, and it's like when it's sort of a small sort of PTSD thing where something will trigger a memory of something that I wrote, and I'll just start shuddering, like, oh my God, how could I have written that? You know, like how could I? So negatively, I think it comes up quite a bit, and I don't know what that says about me. Actually, I do know what it says about
me. Like what? Like when you're in the grocery store and maybe you see someone pass you in the aisle that you wrote about?
Not anymore, because once I moved out to the suburb, it's like I became invisible and I was able to take a deep breath. But I always felt I had this very narcissistic thing about me, I guess, like where I felt like somebody noticed me and said, oh, she wrote that, or, you know, whereas like nobody, I'm sure no one cared. No one even noticed me, you know, and what I wrote for the most part is not memorable, and I dwell on things because issues.
So what is your life like now, post gossip column? It's been how many years?
Ten years. Mm-hmm. A lot has changed. I'm a stay-at-home mom. I have 6-year-old twins. I moved out to a suburb, and I've been out there for 4 years, and I've only just recently started finding friends that would not be just scandalized over, you know, what I used to write or who this person was.
There's access, though, because of the internet, to all the columns.
Mm-hmm.
If someone was trying to get to know you, since you were a character, they could read these.
Mm-hmm.
Does that freak you out?
Sometimes. I mean, my husband has never read anything that I've written, and I asked him not to when we first met, And I don't think it would change the way that he felt about me, but there's just, I said way too many things that were inappropriate and, you know, just I tattled on myself too much.
Is that a trust thing with your husband? Is that him allowing you space to be who you are now?
Definitely. I mean, back then it was very fresh because I met him in 2004 and I stopped in 2004. Somehow he was the one person living six blocks away from me who read The Stranger, who had never read anything I'd written and who was very much into music. So I don't understand how that happened. But now if I were to have met him, I'm a little more over myself, I guess, you know, so I'd be like, yeah, that's who I used to be. If it affects you, changes your mind, how you feel about me, then so be it.
Do you regret it?
No. You can't ever have a better past, you know, so I don't regret it. And I had so much fun and I got to do a job that I was very well aware of while I was doing it that a lot of people wanted to be doing. And, you know, I was lucky.
Do you still read gossip?
All the time. Not as much as I used to. I mean, I used to, like, have, you know, open up my browser in the morning and I was, like, page six and, you know, like, any kind of gossip all over the world. Gossip is still quite the pastime.
So you still crave it in the same way that you did, like, as a kid. You still need to consume that information.
Yeah.
What's the appeal still after all these years of knowing the behind the scenes?
I have no idea. It drives my husband crazy. He doesn't understand why I have to know everything about everything and why I'm always trying to figure out if the neighbors across the street are going on vacation or if she must be pregnant because there was a stroller I saw get delivered the other day or something. You know, he's like, why do you care? Why do you even care?
For me as a journalist, part of what drives me is that I really like listening to people. I really like finding out about people. But I also am kind of obsessed with this idea of why. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you doing that?
It's the big thing.
I'm still that little kid that's mm-hmm. just pulling at a shirt tail saying, why? Mm-hmm. Does it feel like that for you?
It is. And it's why. And then there's also I don't know if this comes from being shy, but wanting to find it out myself rather than ask. It's a little puzzle. You know, and, you know, I feel all satisfied when I knew it, you know.
Kathleen Wilson, former gossip writer, spoke with Sound Effects senior producer Armin Nix. Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix and Kevin Kniestedt. Matthew Strive contributed reporting this week. We had web help from Mike Lewis, and our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can find our podcast on iTunes, and if you feel like taking a minute to write us a review, please do that. It's really helpful. Or you can just tell us what you think. You can email soundeffect@kplu.org or tweet at KPLU. See you here next week when we leave behind our comfort zone.
There's something in my tights.
What's
it is bothering my toes. Oh. I thought there was socks under here.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.